This is the third of this series on trans issues. In the first year, we went through issues of cross-dressing. What we showed is that there seems to be incoherence in the tradition that we did not solve. On the one hand, the tradition seems very strongly to take the position that the purpose which governs the halakha, right, that we determine the halakha based on that purpose in many ways, is to avoid people of one gender being able to infiltrate areas that are exclusive to the other gender for fear that they will use that infiltration as a way of having liaisons. And that seemed to suggest that cross-dressing would not be forbidden anytime that people were still, people's biological gender was still visible and evident to everybody. And on the other hand, at least the Ramah paskins that it's forbidden deoraita for people to wear only one garment of the other sex, even though the rest of the garments would clearly identify them. So that was an incoherence that we opened up in the first week, and we'll see, hopefully next week, perhaps we'll be able to take some advantage of it. In the second week, we talked about the position that is attributed to the Tzitz Eliezer, which is a claim that reassignment, however you want to describe the surgery, is effective on the grounds that halakha determines sex entirely by external genitalia. We showed, I hope convincingly, although it didn't convince Teig, that the Tzitz Eliezer does not in fact hold that position at all. The Tzitz Eliezer was dealing with an imaginary form of surgery, which involved the creation of effective reproductive organs, or failing that, at least of effective sexual organs. And so, in fact, there is no precedent for a claim that surgery per se is effective. Although there are sources that certainly suggest that we don't believe as an immutable principle that men cannot become women and women cannot become men, because there are all sorts of reports that we find medically difficult, but were accepted in halachic literature that men became women and women became men, just not via surgery, right, spontaneously. We also saw that one position, which the Tzitz Eliezer seemed to accept, is that we not only do we believe that men can become women and women can become men spontaneously, but they can shift back and forth. And that was a definition that the Magen Avraham quotes in one place of an androgynous, and it seemed that the Tzitz Eliezer in his last tshuva accepted that's what an androgynous is. An androgynous is somebody who shifts back fertile from male to female by month, which is, again, not something that is currently known. Okay, what we're going to do this week is a follow-up. The same way that the Tzitz Eliezer is often quoted as the only source about transsexual surgery, which it is, it's just misunderstood. So there's a book which is quoted as the only source about the halachot of transsexuals, the work called Dor Tapuchot, Upside Down Generation, written by Rabbi Idan Ben Ephraim and published in 2003. Rabbi Ben Ephraim is a Sephardi. He seems to have been a Talmud of Avadia at some point, and of other major Sephardic figures. And other than that, very little is known, I would say, at least, you know, not broadly known. And he deserves enormous thanks and credit just for taking on the task. Right? No one else wrote a book about this, and he wrote a book about this, and that was a risky thing, and he deserves credit for it. And it's a fair question whether the first book on a subject is often the best book on a subject, and whether one should allow halakha to solidify. I can say that when rabbis ask me, like, what book can you recommend about halachot for transsexual issues, there's only one book, for good or for ill. I started looking at it a few years ago and started having real issues with it. I want to credit that I found a shiur for Rabbi Ezra Schwartz online where Baruch Shekivanti, we both saw the same issue, the same major issue with it simultaneously. I want to credit Dan Wiesenfeld, who isn't here, for a conversation about a month ago that also pointed up a weakness in the book. What I want to do with you tonight is to try and present the book to you in its own terms, and we have to analyze it in two different ways. This is an important thing to get about halakha. We have to analyze whether we think that he reaches the three ways, really. Whether we think he reaches the right conclusions in the cases he deals with. You have to figure out whether he reaches the right conclusions for the right reasons. An interesting thing that happens in halakha sometimes is that people reach the right conclusions for the wrong reasons or for unsustainable reasons. And then we have to figure out what do we do, right? If we if we can't find a way to, as is, to make sense of the answers, but the answers seem to be right. And then the third question is, does he deal with the right questions at all? Right? Is right? Are the cases he's discussing the cases that we have to deal with? Okay, so Dor Ephraim begins by saying that the genesis of this book, Haratoshel Sefer Zen, I apologize for typos where I was rapidly copying off a PDF, was that it was asked by one of my friends who became a Baal Tshuva, and he really wants to learn, he wants to do everything right al pi halacha, and he has a sister who transitioned with full surgery, and now that sister is also interested in joining their halachic Haredi community, and they want to know what to do. They want guidance. Now he tells you up front, and he tells you this twice in the introduction, he tells the chapter, he thinks that the surgery was absolutely forbidden. And he uses quite harsh language about the surgery, right? He says shikutz, he says toiva, right? He uses really harsh language. Now you could claim that he does that dafka to set up a sympathetic halacha later, or you could say that's what he really believes. That he thinks that there's no excuse for the surgery. I will tell you that in support of the he really believes it reading is that on one of the, I imagine, the right-wing homosexual Orthodox Israeli sites, he has a tshuva in which he bans transsexual surgery even for people who claim that they will otherwise be suicidal. So it seems likely that he means it, that he means it for real. And nonetheless, right, let's, you know, that how you defend that, that's a whole separate issue, right? But that is the position that he takes in that tshuva, which I assume is authentic. It's on the front of the site. One, and here's two. Yeah. So he quotes.
How could then, you know, say removing one's sexual organs be less?
So we can. First of all, it's much easier to permit that for women than for men.
I'm sorry.
It's much easier to permit that for women than for men.
Yeah. Okay.
And secondly, if you could make the claim that it's necessary, we nowadays tend to treat mental health on the same grounds as physical health. So if you can make the claim that it's necessary for mental health, you could make that argument. The more interesting claim, I think, is to talk about, I think it would be more interesting, but I have not seen that argument made explicitly, in the same way that if you took the position that somebody who is successful, right, in the miraculous cases discussed by the Sitz Eliezer, so afterwards, right, you don't need a get, your marriage just dissolves. So who committed the prohibition? If you have a new person there who is not, right, who is not considered a castrate, but considered a woman, say, so did they commit? Right? Did they commit the prohibition of castrating a man? Right? The man they castrated doesn't exist. Right? So you could resolve it that way if you really wanted to. His presentation of this is absolutely forbidden. And as I say, right later, right, he has a tshuva that he takes that position as well. Whether I agree with that is not the issue tonight. Right? I'm just trying to explore his position. Right, he talks about procreation and right and self wounding and right and self castration. Right, he has five prohibitions. Then he claimed is also against the order of nature. Right, I asked you in Chavrut to consider the question, like, where does he get the idea that the order of nature is not disturbing the order of nature is a per se Jewish value? You know, it's not one that we tend to think of when it comes to electric power plants, but we think of it all of a sudden when it comes to cloning. It's really interesting what we consider to be part of nature and what not, and beyond. I love quoting one. I think the great theological chiddush of Russ Soloveitchik is the valorization of technology. Right, he thinks that dignity means control of the environment, and so the more human technology advances, the more human dignity we have. So interesting that all of a sudden we have boundaries. And everyone, when we did a couple of years ago, we did genetic CRISPR. And genetic editing. So it was really interesting how my teacher, by J. David Blaich, who normally absolutely denies natural law, but when it came to genetic editing of embryos, all of a sudden he said, "No, there is one natural law and principle in Judaism, which is you can't edit embryos." because it's interfering with creation, right? So everyone has their boundaries where all of a sudden, you know, they develop natural law, and he has, right? This is for him, right? You're interfering with the order of the creation. But we interfere with the order of creation every time, so you have to have some kind of prior intuition that this is like a really important order of creation that God tells us to leave alone, and it's very hard to figure out which are the things that you should leave alone and which are the things that you shouldn't. Maybe what we should leave alone is not split the atom. Right? That might have been a good idea. Right? And splitting atoms seems to be very much against the order of creation. Yes?
No, that argument specifically made in books about favoring segregation and
right.
laws banning miscegenation.
Yeah, people, right? And you know what? People can make arguments, you know, for their natural order, which are very much reflections of biases. The fact that bad arguments can be made in a particular structure doesn't prove that you can't make good arguments in it. It's just, right, it's just difficult to demonstrate which are the good arguments, which are the bad arguments. And in terms of Jewish tradition, it's an interesting question as to how one makes arguments about which orders of creation one preserves and what one does not. Nachmanides, for example, makes an argument that it's essential to preserve species, but the problem with that is it's very hard to define species. Right, we have to preserve every single form of finch in the Galapagos Islands, or is it okay if we just have, you know, there are birds that are kind of brown and fly flit around? Right, that's all the one species. We can call them finches. Right, it's very hard. It's very hard to know how to apply Ramban halakhically. Okay, but what the introduction of Dor Tapuchot does? Let's just say he says one other thing. He says he thinks that, and he has. Earlier Chuvot that he quotes from figures who are not well known nowadays, and what the Chuvot all say is, I don't want to answer this question. It's not. Do I need to speak up here? No. Right. It's not worth it to me to answer this question. I think this is prohibited, and answering it only encourages people. So what he does in the introduction is he justifies himself by saying, "But I can't not answer questions from Balei Tshuva who desperately want to learn." And what these Balei Tshuva want to learn is they've already undergone the surgery. Now what do I do? So, right, so that gives him a particular person to address. But then when you think about what the book means, you have to say, okay, would he give the same answer to people, which I think is the vast majority of cases we have nowadays, people who want to be Orthodox, but not because they experience any, they're not detransitioning, they're not experiencing any regret about what they did. This is who I am and I want to be Orthodox. All right, so it's not clear that his book is addressed to that. Okay, all right, he says, you know, that he felt an obligation to answer the questions from his friend and his friend's sister/brother, but he puts brother in quotes, and Hebrew pronouns don't help any, I think, in terms of figuring out what his attitude is. So he has to answer the questions. So he starts off by saying that it's completely that the surgery itself is completely forbidden. Some of the reasons he gives for the surgery being completely forbidden, though, are contingent. For example, he says it causes your parents great pain, so it's a violation of Kibbutz Av Aim. So that's great if you're right, you know, as a reason, if your parents are opposed and cause great pain. But if your parents are supportive, that's not going to be a great halakhic reason to forbid. Might work for the other reasons, but so it's worth taking a look at each of his reasons and see which of them apply, which of them don't apply. Right. The prohibition to procreate applies obviously much more to men than to women, applies much more to men who haven't fulfilled their obligation already than to men who have, right, to men who haven't fulfilled their obligation as opposed to men who have fulfilled their obligation. So each of those arguments deserves a little bit of work. But here's the key point he makes. We'll read it on page 4 or the end of page 3 in the Hebrew, and this is the point that generates all his halakhic creativity. However, in certain halakhic, right, he starts off, again, the surgery has no effect on halakhic sex. That's an absolute statement he makes. He considers the possibility that Tzitz Eliezer thought otherwise, and then I think he actually reads Tzitz Eliezer exactly the way I read it last week, that Tzitz Eliezer was dealing with an imaginary surgery which actually created effective organs of sex and or procreation. There is no such thing. If you look at strengthening that reading, if you look at his introduction, you'll see that he quotes any number of tshuvot where people explicitly respond to that claim. Right. I was asked the question halakhically about what happens if somebody undergoes surgery in a case where they insert a uterus into a biological male. Right. That was only tried once, so far as I can tell, in the 1930s. But apparently, the way halakhic questions were asked, it was commonly asked in that sort of hypothetical. Okay. So having said that, he doesn't believe that the surgery affects halakhic sex. He then says the following: however, in certain halakhic matters, we do not consider a human's original form of creation. Rather, we relate to him in accordance with his present external appearance. And if you look a little bit earlier on the page, you'll see that he says the reason that surgery doesn't change halachic sex is that your neshama is still what it is, and that halachic obligations, he says, are determined by your initial form and your neshama. That's a difficult thing to verify empirically. Yes, Russ.
So for people who might have, I think this, I noticed this language, and I was very interested, right? Bitzurat Priyato Rishanahim.
Yeah.
Right? And your initial form is what is determining. And I just wonder about, like, so is he anti, like, cochlear implants? Because it would change your original form,
right? Same issue.
And alter your and change your halakhic requirements.
No, yeah. He is anti Brit Milah.
I'm just saying, like,
right,
it's a really interesting.
Yeah, thing. Same issue as trade the orders of nature, right? Rabbi Kiva famously says, right, that's what Miriam's referring to, that when the Roman attacks Rabbi Kiva and says, how can you improve on creation through circumcision? Rabbi Kiva says, we eat bread, right? Not flour. Right, that's right. So we have a Jewish belief that you can improve the body. The body is deliberately left to be perfected. So it's a very interesting argument. It tells you what his instincts are. But it's also interesting that he frames the argument about obligation around souls, particularly since he's aware that there are Kabbalists who believe that there are, right, that sometimes masculine souls can be implanted in feminine bodies and vice versa. He could have said it doesn't work just because the surgery, which he says elsewhere, it doesn't work because the surgery only creates appearances and nothing, right, and nothing actually functional. He doesn't actually say that, which is an interesting thing about himself, about him. We want to try and go through it. So now, but let's take a look again at the, right, he says it to some extent, right, he says all the more so above, he says, as it has been clarified that the formation of the sexual organs of these people is substanceless and their organs are exclusively artificial. So he really has two strands to his argument. One is this surgery is not, right, doesn't do anything. And two, even if you could find a more effective surgery, he still thinks that wouldn't work either. But, you know, I don't know how far that would go.
I don't think the cochlear implant is at all relevant because we say the doctors can heal people, right?
Yeah.
Not being able to hear is viewed as obviously a very negative thing, right?
Right. Well, the reason Rez wants to ask you this is because halachically, right, deaf mute people are not chayav in mitzvot. So she wanted to give an example of somebody, yeah, right, somebody's so, status for mitzvot changing.
And if you said Shalom Zanikisha this morning, you're in a poor position to think that we don't think that there would be one than the other.
Or psychoactive drugs. Right. Which can turn you from a shota into a pikeah.
No, but my status as obliged by halacha does not change based on having, you know, cancer surgery. Like, that doesn't alter or a heart implant.
But it might if you had a corneal transplant.
Right. Okay, yeah.
All right, so being able to see it, right? To the extent that blindness is a halachic category that affects chiyuvim, so, right. Right, so being able to see changes that. And it's, you know, it's certainly, I think, you know, we could say that blindness on the whole is a biological category. You know, we can divide the world into people who are blind and people who are not. It's not a function of social. I mean, you can then talk about it, of course, right? We have legal blindness and things like that. But basically, right, it's a reasonable binary. Okay, here's, again, we're on bottom of page 4. He says, however, in certain halakhic matters, we do not consider a human's original form of creation. Rather, we relate to him in accordance with his present external appearance. Right, so that's a really interesting way of expressing it. Right, so We relate to him in accordance with his present external appearance. Does that mean present external appearance clothed? Does it mean present external appearance unclothed? Does it mean, right, does it mean, does present external appearance has to mean that people cannot tell what you, right, what your birth gender was, or what your birth sex was? Or is it just a function of social appearance? So he doesn't say here, he doesn't see here carefully, but he has fascinating examples. He says, for example, the prohibitions of wearing clothing. Right? So he thinks that the prohibition of wearing the other sex's clothing, if you have undergone full surgery, then you are obligated to wear the clothing of the sex you appear as opposed to the sex you were born as. Right, now that's it, right? That's, I think, you know, if we ask people up front, right, how do we distinguish, right, what things are dependent on biology and what things are dependent on something else, we would have thought that, okay, the prohibition against cross-dressing, that would be one of those, right, the obligation would be for your clothing to match your biological sex. But the Dor HaBechot says not that way. He says that you have to match, that your clothing has to match your post-operative sex. So that's right. So that you can see why that would be seen by some people as a marvelously liberating psak. Right here, right. It looks like somebody is, for all his denials, it looks like somebody is accepting transformation because here a major halachic shift has been made. Yes, Maxine. I mean,
that seems to contradict, though, the isurim that he lists regarding surgery. I mean, because, you know, if he says lo yilbash, I'm assuming that the change of the appearance is not in accord with whatever he thinks the kind of...
The chain of appearance is wrong. You shouldn't have done it.
Right. But the fact that then you will be over on lo yilbash, but then he says that you should dress in accordance with, you know, whatever the physical appearance...
Because he thinks that once you've had the surgery, perhaps, right, one already, you are permanently over... Lo yilbash in one direction, don't make it worse by violating it twice. Now he thinks this because he thinks that, right, because he thinks very, very strongly, as we learned the first week, that the prohibition against cross-dressing is based entirely on infiltrating spaces of the other sex, right, so as to have liaisons with them. And then he thinks one further thing. He thinks that people who have, I'll show you this, I think, on... I think it's on page 6. I think you probably won't believe me unless you read it, but it's really important. What page is it? Tells you. Darn it. Okay. I'll. Here. Let's about page 7. Right on page 7, he says. Mm-hmm. He says, my dear friend Rabbi Yossi Tzror Shlita pointed out to me that even if a person changed their sex and wears the clothes of the prior sex, for example, a woman transformed into a man wearing women's clothing, it appears that we should not apply the prohibition must not wear, because even if this man were now to be frequent among women and have sex with them, his sex would not fall within the category of Gili Erva and Toiva mentioned in Torah, since his male organ is artificial and halachically meaningless. However, in my humble opinion, while it's a good point, nonetheless, we should obligate this man, meaning this, right, this trans man, to wear men's clothes and not women's, since his sexual acts are prohibited as lesbianism, that is categorized as acts of the lands of Mitzrayim. So you can't allow, right? You can't allow a trans man to hang out among women, because that would, right? Because that would lead to acts of lesbianism. Now, why would it lead to acts of lesbianism? Because he tells you at the end, right? He says we're not worried that this trans man will violate issues and have non-vaginal sex with men. That's not a concern. The same way he says yichud is not a concern. Trans men can function among men, right? Can be alone with men. There's no issue with yichud. Why? Because when a woman has undergone real change in her body and looks like a full male and has also undergone matching hormonal treatment and has no desire for men. Right, this is the point Rabbi Ezra Schwartz made, which I think is absolutely crucial, that the Dor HaBechot is based on a premise that the hormonal treatment that goes along with sex reassignment makes you heterosexual in the new sex. And so all his liberal psakim, about clothing, about negiyah, about yichud, are built on this assumption that right, that if you have somebody who's biologically female, and then they undergo the surgery and hormonal treatment to become right to become male, they will now be attracted to women and not men. Now that, let's say, it's not entirely true. I think that's a fair statement. There is, you know, I thought it was just nonsense. That seems to be an overstatement, because there is some impact to hormonal treatments apparently on sexual orientation, not well measured, but it's certainly not generally true. Statistically, it seems much more likely to be the other way. So now the question is: so what do we do with the Dor HaTapuchot? I understand, right? It's very attractive for some people to say that, well, look, let's just postulate like the Dor HaTapuchot, and that lets trans people function socially largely as the sex they have transitioned to, because they're allowed to hang out in spaces of that sex. They're allowed to wear the clothing of that sex. In fact, they're not allowed to wear the clothing of the previous sex. They're allowed to touch people of that sex. But all that is based on a presumption about their sexual orientation, which is empirically false. All right. So what do we do halachically? Now you might say, I don't like the conclusion either. But even if you like the conclusion, right? What do you do with it when it's based on, you know, I guess in a very modern sense, it's based on really, really not seeing the person in front of you. Okay. Yes, Deborah, and then Ari.
Am I understanding?
He's not going to allow this person to marry anybody. That is probably correct, yeah. Oh, no, it's a trans woman to men. No, I think he might allow the person to marry a man, but he just doesn't, he might allow a trans man to marry a man because they're still biologically female. He just doesn't think they'd be interested, because we don't know about homosexuality in this universe.
Still can't reproduce.
Can't reproduce, right? Whether the man would be allowed to marry them is a more complicated question.
It'd be sterile.
Right, because the trans male, right, is sterile, right?
No, so, but if the other man is also sterile.
Yeah, it's just weird.
Not necessarily, sometimes men
have babies.
Not after surgery.
Okay.
Right, now, again, we have to remember that part of the challenge I want to talk about this is that he only talks about post-surgical, post-hormonal treatment cases, which doesn't tell you what to do as a community when you're trying to make rules for people, when you're trying to make rules as a community. And I want to argue that the last thing you want to do as a community is to say, well, we're going to treat you exactly the same until you have surgery, because that just drives you to surgery. Right? Prima facie, that's a policy to avoid, right? One which says that if there are things you want, you can have them only by only through surgery. I think that it really needs to be thought about, because I think that a lot of the attraction of Dor HaTapuchot comes from the correct recognition that the psak leads to an outcome that enables people to function socially well, enables people also to function in Orthodox synagogues, because you can sit on that side of the mechitza, right? And you know, and the fact that it comes with lots of rhetoric that you did something wrong initially is less bothersome than interfering with your life currently, but the rationale behind it makes no sense. Okay, Ari had his hand up before.
Maybe this is not important, but does the fact that he was, you know, maybe objectively wrong about the issue of sexuality important, given that things like yichud and negiyah, already we don't have any guardrails in place for homosexual people, right? They're not subject to the laws of yichud and negiyah.
So I think it's a really interesting question. With regard to homosexuality, we generally say, although that's a whole separate project, right, that we just, you know, that society functions on a heterosexual presumption. All right, that's how it, right? Otherwise nobody could ever be alone with anybody else.
But so he's just extending that presumption.
That's correct. He's extending the heterosexual presumption. But why would you do that unless you think it actually works? Right? It's a hard move to make, right? To say that the heterosexual presumption should be dependent on social appearance as opposed to biology. It could be done, I guess, but it's a hard move to make. It's not the move he makes. Right? He makes an empirical claim.
You could still make it because, you know, there's things that you can negate, et cetera, right, depend on two actors, right? And so the assumption would be that whoever the man was that she was in yichud with would not be attracted.
Okay, so let's talk about two separate elements of this. One is this assumes, right, I know that right, one of the students said that I might get in trouble for using the word passing, so I apologize if that's not the right word. This assumes that that trans people are indistinguishable, right, from others of the the new sex, right? If you're making this wild claim about how people function in terms of sexual orientation, right, it requires at least that. So that doesn't cover lots of people. And now we have to start, you know, drawing. How do you know? Okay, we can make presumptions. Most people can't, right? Hard. Secondly, again, his logic only applies in his universe to post-operative, post-terminal treatment people. What about people who are just engaging in social transition? His logic doesn't work. Now, you can make a new logic that does, but you can't use his authority for it because he's building on an empirical claim, and that won't be true in cases of purely social transition. Yes, Gershon.
On the assumption that we're not going to start checking genitals, isn't the existence of a test case where it would be okay to transition across from a pizza enough to change the social norm by itself?
Okay, so we could claim, right? We could claim that, you know, that we're going to start off by saying there's a case, and then we're going to, right? This is sort of a fancy version of what Arya did, right? Then we have one case, and then we say, okay, well, we need to say lo plug, because we can't actually ask people to verify their sex before they enter either side of the mechitza, and therefore, since there are some people who even though we knew they were previously biologically male are now socially female who can daven on that side, we're not going to make choice. Right? That's a pragmatic way to get to the same result. Could be. It's just not the argument he makes. Could be. Yes.
And then one of the example questions you had on, I think, page 5 was about things like circumcision for conversion. There might be cases where there are trans people who they're converting. There might be ways where, you know, their genitals will be seen, and that to the extent has its limits, it runs to that.
Interesting. That would be an extreme case, I think.
But I know of trans people who have worked on.
But one of the questions I'm interested in, I know, but he thinks that, right, that, you know, that post surgery there'd be no possibility of circumcision either way. I forgot what I was going to say. Oh well. Yeah. Oh, so I want to point out that even there's another category that he doesn't talk about, which is what about people who, in fact, now appear to be of the other sex, but everyone in their community knows them from before.
That's the problem with the don't ask, don't tell.
It's
just somebody to leave the community, and that's not what we want.
Right. So the question is: does his logic depend on that? Right. If his logic is based on how people react erotically. To them, so do people react erotically based entirely on appearance? You know, there seems to be a lot of empirical evidence that that's not exactly how people react based on how people react to certain kinds of dress-up shows. So it's an interesting claim. I think what, you know, the conversation shows is that it might be possible, if you really wanted to get to similar results, but you can't do it the way he did, so you can't claim his authority, and that's always a question of what you want to do. Right? Are those really the results you want to reach? And do they make sense? Right? Do they make sense in the end that way, in terms of what the goals of the halachic system are? I don't know. I think it's worth thinking about, like, what our goals are in terms of yichud, what our goals are in terms of negiah. what our goals are in terms of space. Okay, here's another set of things. How he handles halachic distinctions between men and women that are not fundamental, but are based on issues like this. So he comes up with, I think, some fairly astonishing results, but he'll tell me. So let's say, for example, do you think that, let's play it out, right? So do you think, in his logic, which remember the surgery has absolutely no impact on biological sex. Do you think that trans men should count for minyan? Yes or no? Yeah.
Asking him.
In his, right, according to him. What do you think he would say? Yes, Deborah.
So he's creating something of a problem here because he's telling them that they have to wear men's clothes and sit on the men's side of the mezuzah. And all of that seems to rely on no one being able to tell that they're not just like everybody else. But if he's not going to let them count dominion, they also have to tell everybody else.
That's correct.
So, it doesn't work.
That's correct, because, mm-hmm. again, he's talking to Balei Tshuva, right, who are expressing regrets. So they'll be willing to do that. Right? I think that's the point. Right? He doesn't see it as his goal to facilitate the inclusion of trans people in the community. He sees it as his goal to facilitate the re-inclusion of trans Balei Tshuva into the community. And so that's right. And so that's part of what you always demanded of reintegration in the community in the past, right? It doesn't tend to be what we do in modern Orthodoxy, but it's traditional. Is a certain amount of public humiliation, and ideally ongoing public humiliation, right? Because that's how you show you really repent, by being willing to suffer, right? To suffer socially for your sins. So you do things like, I love quoting Professor Lyman's Shear about the transition from atonement to repentance. Professor Lyman said that why are some cultures about repentance instead of atonement? So he reads from a medieval manual in Ashkenaz, where there was a woman who committed adultery, and then she repents and she comes to the rabbi and says, "Well, what should I do? I committed adultery." The rabbi says, "Well, because you're repenting, right? We don't want to impose voluntarily." We don't want to impose a heavy penitence on you. So all you have to do is go to the synagogue in every city in which you committed adultery, and lie down in the doorway, and let everyone walk over you each day for 30 days in each of these synagogues in winter. And in summer, you should take all your clothes and sit outside in a barrel of water so all the insects can sting you. And it goes on like this for 20 pages. Imagine if people weren't from. Right? 20 years of Chilul Shabbos. Like, what would the atonement look like, right? So we don't tend to be really really harsh in it, but it was a standard thing. People had to confess their sins publicly, repeatedly, before the community would accept them back, right? So he's, I think, perfectly fine to set up a model like that, where people carry badges of their past sins. But that may not be where we are going. I think that you're right that he doesn't have a model in which it's not known. Now, how that relates to, as I pointed out, to his claim, his model of sexual attraction is, it maybe that's just an incoherence. Yes, Alexis.
Well, I wonder if part of that might be because he starts out with the premise of this is one individual person. So, if his congregant came to him and said, my sibling transitioned, is now a man, but he had surgery, he still takes hormones, and he's only attracted to women. So maybe this rabbi then said, okay, so I'm going to assume that could be true of anyone who goes.
I don't know what research he did. He did, in his introduction, he did some research, he talked to people. And that's why I think it's very important to know that people who talk to people are not thereby immune to mistakes. You don't always understand everything. You can pick the wrong person to talk to, right? It's not right. Consultation does not resolve the problem of mistakes.
Especially if done over the internet.
Okay, right. Well, I think this was pre-internet, probably in most ways, but sure. Before we get to Minyan, let's take a much easier one. Assuming that you have male and female cemeteries, so are you buried? Are you buried in the cemetery? Yes, people do have male and female cemeteries. It's very important, as you know, because right, that's how we know that you can't wear tzitzit in a women's cemetery. No, 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 that's very real. That's very real. Somebody just quoted at me again. It's a question why you can't wear tzitzit in women's cemeteries. The whole reason you can't wear tzitzit is that, right, it's lo yig v'rosh, they can't do the mitzvah, but in a women's cemetery, they're not chayiv the mitzvah anyway. Nonetheless, that is, right, the fact that there is a question about whether you can wear your tzitzit out in a women's cemetery proves that there is such a thing as women's cemetery. So you have a whole long discussion that it's not halachic, it's just minug. Nonetheless, according to the minug, where there are cemeteries where men and women are buried separately, which one do you bury somebody in, their natal sex or their social sex? So he says that burial follows the soul and not the body, and therefore you get buried in accordance with your birth sex. Isn't that pretty astonishing? Like, you know, every stage of the argument, you think I'm going the other way, right? Right, every stage of the argument, but that's where he ends up. Yes.
Aren't there some number of trans people who say that their soul was always one
right.
gender and
somehow
into the
and
wrong body?
And he knows about that, and yet when it comes to halacha, he just throws it out the window.
So he, neshama goes with birth sex.
Yes.
Not.
Yeah, unless he might allow you, right? He might allow people who had demonstrated precisely what their sex was. Those of you, you probably watched Babylon 5, no? You know, there's a way of determining minbari souls, right? So if you have a gender determination, the way you can tell minbari souls, right, that everything is good. I don't know what it would be, but you can try it. Those of you who haven't, now you have to watch the first episode. Yes.
Just curious,
9 days, of course.
Does he say what gender the cover?
Yes, the Chevra Kedisha should be that of the body. And then bury you on the side of the soul. Because the Chevra Kedisha is an issue of tzias.
Yeah, but if we say that, you know, the biological sex isn't changed, even when the appearance is...
But tzias is an issue of appearance.
I'm offended
by that. Yes, Harvey.
I think that there's a tradition among some... indigenous Americans that some people have two souls, one of each.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can't tell you anything about that. And the truth is that most Kabbalistic souls go back and forth, right? People, right, in Kabbalah, souls change status from Mashpia to Mekabel. So it's not really clear that the category masculine, feminine soul in many forms of Kabbalah per se makes so much sense. But I'm not a Kabbalist, so I would not. The issue comes up very often in terms of metempsychosis, right? In terms of reincarnation, right? I wouldn't know how to do it. Yes, Jacob.
I mean, I'm also just confused because I thought, like, on page 4, there was this formulation that, like, yeah, this surgery does not change the body or the soul, and so the body and the soul, I guess,
but the appearance of the body changes, and the sexual orientation of the body changes.
Okay.
Just not the sex, right? That's right. That's his claim, right? The appearance and the appearance, and therefore your erotic relationship with everyone else changes, even though your body stays the same sex, which is a pretty astounding claim. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go back to Minyan. So
I pointed out that we learned philosophy 2 weeks ago. I don't mean to call you off.
No,
it was a good one. that you know, we just learned that Michal had a male soul, which you know apparently did not match her. You know, natal.
Yeah, no, I quoted that, right?
Right.
And he quotes all of that literature more than I quoted. But as I say, when it comes down to making decisions about burial, that was just Bikius to prove to you that he knew it. He doesn't play out halakhically.
No, I guess my question is. So we're finding that there's inconsistencies, there's internal errors in terms of science and in terms of halacha. And so I think the question that you're kind of asking is, should we, you know, what do we do with something that doesn't necessarily hold together?
Yeah.
And honestly, I mean, I'm just going to put it out there because I'm not you. But, I'm just me. But we do that all the time. You know, I mean, we say that we can't use electricity because, you know, sparks, but that hasn't been true for decades. Microphones, you know, the thing, science changes and our understanding of the world changes. And nevertheless, we keep what we choose to keep as a community. And so I'm not sure that it's necessary that he be internally consistent.
Could be if it worked. If it worked, it might work. If we think it works, that's why I want to do everything to make sure that we think it works.
And I think that the fear, the other like kind of meta thought fear that was raised earlier, that, you know, perhaps we don't want to do something that's going to encourage people to get what they want through surgery. You know, I would very much like to be considered to be equal to men. Very much. I would very much like to not have people all around me, you know, waiting for a 10th man because I'm sitting here and I'm just not Jewish right. enough or whatever it is. I don't like hearing people say Shlo Asani Isha. And that's very painful. But I'm not going to have surgery because
right.
that's not what I need for my personal to express my identity to make it right for me.
That's right.
But that means that people aren't going to do surgery to get what they want. They're going to do surgery to get what they need, and it doesn't matter what we say. And therefore,
yeah.
I don't think that should be part of our determination.
So that's a fair. I think I need to do a lot more research to find out what, you know, the conversation I've had so far suggests that for most people, the physical and the social are, you know, in terms of what you want and need are very intertwined. But I don't know enough to say that with confidence yet. That's why I'm still working within the Dor HaPluchot. By next week, I need to know more. yes.
I just like to speak to the, like, as one trans person, you know, there's, surgery's not something that's on my mind right now. And like, if I was treated as a man before I had to go to surgery, or before I got surgery and had to get surgery in order to be treated like a woman, I don't know that that would still be the case, right? I think there is a decent chance that I would be pushed towards surgery that may not be medically necessary otherwise.
That's my impression when I'm talking now, but I don't know, but I don't have numbers, right? I have anecdotes. So I'm going to try it, right? So that's not your... But I thank you for the anecdote. Of course, the problem is it reinforces my biases. So that's a... that's a risk. Okay. So let's play out Miriam's case precisely. He holds, by the way, that trans men should still say Shlo trans men should say Shasani Kirtzano and trans women should say Shlo Asani Isha. Which is just something that interests me because one of the things I love quoting from a trans student, Deborah and I had again, when you know, people complained about Shlo Asani Isha, so he said trans male students said actually that Shlo Asani Isha was the most important bracha because what happened to him shouldn't happen to anybody else, right? So that's a right. So that's a really that you know that's a really interesting counterpoint to where the Dor HaPluchot ends up. He says that. Trans men do not count to minion because minion is a function of biology, but that trans women also don't count to minion because you can't have a minion that goes across the men's and women's section.
Has he ever gotten to all the shows where women can't get in because there are men and women?
I assume that in his show, we're very careful to keep the women's section far enough away that there are no men in it.
Well, I think he holds like his teacher Avadi Yosef because I think Avadi Yosef holds that the women's section
is not part of the
it's not part of the bit
yeah
of the
right which is a, not he holds that trans men may wear tallit and tefillin but may not make a bracha because he holds that it's not yura because you appear male so it's not yura to wear tallit and tefillin but he's Sephardi so you can't make a bracha whereas trans women must put on talis and fill in with a bracha at home, but can't do so in shul, which is a really interesting set of outcomes. He says that, as far as getting ready, he says that trans men can get aliyot, because there's no intrinsic bar to women getting aliyot, it's just a question of kvod sibur, and kvod sibur is a function of appearance. Yeah. Because Paskins like the Mishnah, which says straightforward that women.
There seems to be, you know, you were saying earlier, there's a level of like kind of I don't know, embarrassment that is going to be inflicted upon the person who, you know, will be counted into a minion, but they can get, like, the keyboard of having an Aaliyah. That sounds a bit...
It's a fascinating outcome. It's an absolutely fascinating outcome. I don't know... is it the outcome that I think is a socially coherent outcome? You could imagine a world in which that was a great compromise, right? Don't count Dominion, but you're getting Aaliyah. And you can imagine a world where everyone says that's just absurd, and in which all the women who don't trans get really, really angry.
Well, I mean, partnership
Minion doesn't work like that. That's exactly partnership
Minion. Yeah, right? Interesting, right? So you go there, right? You live in an automatic, personal partnership bubble.
Yes.
Right, that's a really interesting outcome. Yes, Mitch.
So, what about androgynous? How do we classify as far as today?
Androgynous is generally we classify our Suffolk male. So now the question is, which way? Since the minion is a Suffolk drabbanon, so we can count them to a drabbanon minion, but not for an issue where the minion is deraisa. Right. Why? That androgynous is a Suffolk and these people are not Suffolk. We know what they are. We're just trying to figure out how that plays out halakhically. It's not the same case at all. People keep bringing up androgynous. Like you're in good company. People keep bringing it up and I keep on swatting it down. Because I don't think it's relevant at all. But you're not the only, we're certainly bringing in one of my alumnus already who wrote an article about that, androgynous as the model. I don't think so. I don't think so at all. Yes, Deborah.
I hate to push back on that, but supposing that Minion involves people wearing clothing,
it
seems to present a precedent for a person who is going to have to wear somebody's clothing. I don't know what clothing this person is wearing, but something. And then they're going to have to walk around telling everybody that their clothing doesn't represent who they are.
Yes.
It seems like that does seem to have to have existed, at least as a hypothetical.
Yeah. It seems to be where he ends up. Although with an incoherence, because everyone's supposed to react to them erotically as what they appear as, despite knowing what they actually are in his world.
So I would say that the tradition doesn't assume that people relate in any particular way to an androgynous erotically, which has to mean that either they're wearing a third kind of clothing that no one associates with anything, or what clothing they're wearing isn't what's controlling how people relate to them.
Interesting. Oh. Interesting argument. Okay, now you have salvaged Mitch. Now we can go learn androgynous and try and find some relevance. okay, the last thing that I have on my list of questions that he answers, right? So he says he can't count, a trans male cannot count to a minion, but a trans male can join with two men for a zeman of three, because the issue of forming a zeman of three is pritzos. Right, men and women being socially together. That is its own mystery, right, how we play that out. But not for the Zeman of 10. Because Zeman of 10, right, is an issue of Dover Shabbat Kedusha, and that depends on biology. That's a very hard position to end up in. I think that's a fair presentation. Right, I'll just sum up. Right, the standard book, right? Standard book assumes that surgery is ineffective halachically for anything that relates to your sex, but assumes that that surgery accompanied by hormonal treatment changes one's sexual orientation and changes everyone's sexual orientation towards you. That enables people to function socially in many contexts as a member of the sex they have transitioned to, although there are many circumstances which that seems to require full disclosure. It generates a hodgepodge of results in terms of ritual, some of which probably generate, I think, exactly where Miriam and Deborah are coming from, which is that it seems to say that the halachic difference between men and women is that we make women pay for the status of men by cutting parts of themselves off. Right, and that seems to me to probably be an unfortunate place to end up. I really would not want to. I think in general that that's you know, for me, like, two good starting points would be that we should not have a policy where the reason people have surgery is in order to get things from us. And we should have a policy which tells women the difference in women and men, is nothing to do with who you are as a woman. It just has to do with certain body parts. Which you can remove and replace with something that is not non-functional. And the logic as he gives it doesn't help us deal with people whose transition is neither hormonal, certainly not clear what hormones do by themselves. He never deals with hormones by themselves, but people who just socially transition but don't have issues with their bodies. Right, he doesn't give us any guidelines for addressing that halakhically at all. And let's figure out, like, is that a viable endpoint where we say that we only consider things at such point as they have people, you know, take dramatic physical action and don't just change appearance cosmetically. Okay, there were still questions. Yes, Naomi.
He also seems to have as a condition for everything that people are bal tshuva, right? Are repenting that they made this change and are now trying to come back, which seems to me not to describe many people.
That's correct.
Who don't regret that they've made whatever transition with or without surgery. And don't necessarily see themselves as coming back as opposed to wanting to stay in the community they were in.
Yeah, I think on a purely descriptive level, right, we could have a much richer taxonomy than he gives us, right? We could have people, right, who religiously regret, right? You could have people who actually detransition. You could have people who really think it's the best decision that they made in their lives, but they also really want to remain parts of the Orthodox community, right? Those are the ones who ask the coolest shilas, right? Right, then you have people, you know, who function in relation to Orthodoxy the way many other people do, that they like availing themselves of certain Orthodox services, right? They like being able to come to shul, but they also go to other shuls, right? They like being able, right? There are all sorts of, and then you have the same issues you have with the partially observant in many other areas of, in terms of inclusion in synagogue life, but it's just harder because you have concrete questions. Right, like which side of the mechitza, and issues like that. I think we'd have a much, much richer taxonomy than this book depends on. But again, you know, you could say that, you know, first of all, it's there; it's the only book there is. So maybe, right, and there are many situations in life in which any decision is better than no decision. That's a fair point. So it could be that unless somebody comes up with a system which can command at least as much support and is demonstrably better. Then we don't have anything yet, right? So for me to just get up and tear it down doesn't help anybody, right? Because now people just don't know what to do, and when people don't know what to do, so then they assume that they can't come to shul at all, right? So maybe it's better to have a policy which at least tells you what to do. Now the policy is fudged because we don't actually, right? Because his policy is about post-operative, and we don't have any way of distinguishing between post-operative and pre-operative, so we apply a presumption the way Gershon did, and we're just muddling through. And sometimes muddling through is the only thing you can do. I think it's valuable to recognize when you're just muddling through, as opposed to believing that you've actually made sense of things, especially since I think we all know that numbers are increasing dramatically, and so things that helped us muddle through previously may no longer be viable socially. We haven't addressed non-binary at all, by the way, either, right? Which might totally transform the whole issue. Okay, yes, Tag.
That looked good to me from the things that we have in front of us, and my recollection of the work itself, that the trans person in question regrets their gender transition. Just that they want to be observant now. They come from an unobservant family, and just like their brother, they too would like to be.
So let's be fair. He never talks about that. Right, he talks about them. He talks about them as bali tshuva, right? And he says that the transition was completely forbidden in all sorts of strong terms. It could be that he would, that he would allow himself a certain amount of self-deception. And that I think that it's clear that he thinks they ought to regret because they violated all these Isurim. But he might say, you know what, but what does it matter whether you do or don't, right? You know, right now you want to be from and you can't undo that. But the truth is he has a case which matters, right? Which is that you have an obligation to detransition if you can. Right? He has it right happens if you're in the middle of hormonal treatment, but it's reversible. Right? So I think that makes clear that he thinks that there would be an obligation to detransition if you could, and probably that means that you ought, right, that on a religious level he would tell you you ought to regret. Yes. Rabbi Safra and then Deborah.
Are there any circumstances of gerus where someone would be excluded because of a past of gerus? If they've disavowed it, they've done tshuva. What's behind the question is that would be a unique question in its own right. If it's someone goes to convert and then they are converted to Jew, I mean, theoretically.
Right about conversion. Yeah, conversion.
Conversion, and then they're fully reborn as.
Yeah. So the question is just how you convert somebody, how you convert somebody trans is a much more complicated question. If you're male and if you're biologically male and we think that biological males can't convert without circumcision, that creates a whole sort of issue. Conversion, I think, is beyond our scope tonight. I think that's past. Are there cases? Sure, right. We don't look Kohanim who are murderers. Tshuva doesn't help. Kohanim can't do Birka Kohanim once they've murdered, even if they do tshuva.
But it's not about, so my question specifically with regard to Gator, meaning is there any case where we'd exclude you for something you've done in your bed?
Well, let's say according to the standard position, we exclude people even who were accidentally castrated. Right? It's not a question of sin, it's just a question of biology.
Right.
That more complicated than I thought it was, but that's like a good, you know, that's the 3DH that most people assume is correct. Yes, Deborah.
There's another category that's still missing from your taxonomy, which is this, given that we're a whole community of all different ages and people, people who have not yet made these decisions because they're children and they look to their adults for leadership as to what to do next. But those people are completely without guidance here.
And his world? No.
There's a lot of rhetoric about how they're terrible people. But there's no guidance.
I think his role of guidance would be no one should do this. There are some people who did. They regret it.
He doesn't say what they should
do. He doesn't say what they should do in terms of if they feel that way. Right? If so, he would say he's not a therapist. I think that's an interesting question. To what extent, right? That's I think a powerful question. He's not, because of the way he frames the question, he doesn't have to deal with the challenge of what should those people do.
He doesn't imagine the possibility of people who are genuine.
Based on his later tshuva, in which he utterly bans the surgery, even on grounds of dysphoria, that would seem to be correct. Yes, which would make it very much not the sympathetic book it is usually read as. And again, you have to think about to what extent do you, sometimes the right halacha comes out of a mistake. So you have to decide if you think that's right, if you think that's true in this case. But I think we have to acknowledge that it's right, nobody really is happy with where this book comes from. Even if you're happy, even if you are somewhat happy with where it ends up, but I think we'll discover that probably not so many of us are happy with where it ends up either. They're just specific things that enables you to do that might make some. That might make a lot of us happy, and maybe that's enough. Maybe that's not.
Well, not just make people happy, but allow people to see. Because you can't call somebody who you know a toeva. You know, I mean, that's...
I don't know that anyone. You know, I think that we've carefully avoided using the word toeva as a thing. I started. Johnson Dictionary says it's a loose indeterminate term of censure. I don't know that there's any warrant ever for calling a person a toeva. I don't think there's any warrant anywhere in Jewish tradition for doing that. But you're right that that in his framework, right, you're saying right that people are engaging in, if you take the twisting the laws of the orders of nature thing, you're engaging in ongoing behavior that could be described that way. Sure.
Well, I'm just saying, with the language that he uses, he's clearly like poskening from the ick factor. And I wonder if, you know, people just knew that people are people, you know, and they saw these are real people, that could make a huge difference.
Could be. I don't know which way. You know, that's why, you know, I think you have to be aware that you can be, and I think, you know, you can be an enormously sympathetic human being and still end up with a halakha that is less, you know, creates less space, lots less space than the Dor HaPachod, who happens to create enormous space socially by accident. I'll give you the example, right? This, if you don't know, for the halacha, I always talk about this, but I think it's the best example. Right? There's a psak that has worked enormously well for the Jewish community in terms of relations with Christianity. Right? And that psak is that Christianity is avodah zarah for Jews, but not for Gentiles. That has been like a really good psak for the community for many, many years, and is wrong. Right? It's a misreading of all the medieval texts it's allegedly based on. But it works pretty well. On a mass level. So do you feel like, you know, do you feel like overturning now? That psak has already worked for, let's say, 700-800 years for lots of people. So it has like more of a history than the book that's 20 years old. That's not clear whether it's working at all. But there are times when, you know, when, and also, you know, I tell my students frequently, you know, with examples that get me in trouble, that there are poskim whose reasoning is beautiful, and there are poskim whose intuition is beautiful, and often it's very frustrating because the posik whose intuition is beautiful, whose reasoning is not beautiful. And the posik whose reasoning is beautiful, whose intuition is not beautiful. And now you have to decide which way you paskin. And, you know, when you end up paskining like the posik who can't explain themselves. And that's very frustrating, right? That's very frustrating. You know, for me at least, right? The term they get in trouble, and I have to paskin like the Taz against the Shach and Yerodea. It's extremely frustrating because I can't. Because the arguments just still don't work for me at all. But sometimes it's clear, you know, to me intuitively that that's the right answer. So it could be would end up that way. And it's just my job to point out, you know, as amusement to the Beis Medrash, the way it was in Yerodea, by the way, the Taz Hazrayas really don't work. And everybody said, oh, good, the Taz Hazrayas really don't work. That's good to know. Look, which way do we possibly be possible? Like the Taz, oh, good. right?
I think it's also worth noticing, though, that as frustrating as looking at this is, I need to say that you are addressing it with intellectual honesty and also generosity of spirit and a lot of courage. And I think it's important just to kind of put that out there.
No, I appreciate it. We'll see next week how much of all those I actually sustain when I'm talking in my own voice as opposed to just reading other voices. Maybe I'll just make next week's share just about Deborah Sampson. You know, solving the long-standing halachic mystery. What would we say? What we say about Deborah Sampson? That'll give me a cutout in the end. I think that the shul and the shul and everyone who came deserves enormous credit for having a conversation that's hard for everybody, no matter what their pre-existing opinions are. And it's hard to find somebody who has no opinions. And to some extent, I'm trying the model, just where, you know, working it through, because I don't, you know, I have opinions, but my opinions are not concretized in halacha yet. And trying to figure out, you know, where the space is, what the halacha is. And the halacha, we'll talk about next week, the halacha should allow for positions that you disagree with. And I think that's like the hardest thing as opposed to is figuring out where you tell, because if people ask you the shayla, you give them one answer, but if people just ask the shayla, then there's a range of opinions, and you have to figure out, well, which of the opinions do you think are so wrong that you think you can't eat right, that I would tell you, you can't even rely on that. Right, that's a big part of the psak is often about eliminating options as opposed to validating them. And it's fair, I'll say one more thing which will come up again next week, it's fair because if you don't invalidate them, then you get into what's called in legal theory reliance. Right, if somebody acts based on a psak which they believe is normative in orthodoxy, we'll call it, you know, for random purposes, the Sitz Eliezer. Right? And they organize their life around the Sitz Eliezer because they believe the Sitz Eliezer is a reasonable option in orthodoxy. So if I don't get up and say no, that understanding of the Sitz Eliezer is just wrong. Right? So then someone comes back to me and says, but you didn't tell me that in advance. And meanwhile, I built my life around the assumption that I could live in orthodoxy based on the Sitz Eliezer. Right? That's a fair complaint to me. right? So I have to figure out, like, what things you leave within the pale and what things you shout loudly and attempt to tell people, if you do this, right, I'm not going to feel responsible for the consequences. And then you also have to figure out, but if you shout loudly but everyone else shouts louder than you, and you still want to be long and part of the same movement. So last epigram is, I think that identifying as Orthodox means taking responsibility for the Orthodox past. Right, so that's part of the question, right? You have to figure out, like, what you identify as your Orthodox past, and as long as you identify with it, you have to identify. Then you have to, but the future is going to be the past soon, so you have to affect that. All right, thank you very, very much. People are welcome to come up and ask questions privately afterwards, but we're past some people's bedtime, I think.